Welcome to episode 8 of the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. I'm the co-founder of Reckless Dice and your host, Paul Rorschach-Tobia. With me tonight is co-founder Jesse Gitzman-Burke, and also...
Good evening.
And also on the crew is Dan, I'm too cool for my old handle character.
Hello.
See, in quotes, I had the formerly known as Crimson Avenger Carrick, but Dan decided he didn't want to be called that anymore.
Well, I figured, come on, you guys got like Rorschach, Gitzman.
So you wanted, what you're saying is you wanted something sophisticated and super cool.
Exactly. I want to stand out. I don't want to just be sitting in there in the shadows and everybody goes, who the hell's Crimson Avenger? I want to be like...
See, I think you sounded like a superhero, like from the 80s.
I do.
I picture you in a white leotard and like a red star on your chest.
You know what? I was tortured one year to be in Superman costume. That did not work. Why leotards don't work.
Well, Paul, what do you think the best way to get Dan a new handle is?
Hey, I picked mine, over maybe 12, 14 years ago or something now.
It takes
now,
a long time and you go through some trashy ones on the way. I think, you know what? I think the best way, let's let all of our fans submit any new names for Dan. And Dan, you will abide by whatever the most popular name is, right?
Oh, okay.
I think what we'll do is we'll read them all off on the podcast, and then the rest of us will decide one for you.
Okay, that sounds like a fair challenge. So if any of you guys want to feel nice and decent, create me a good name. I appreciate it.
So Paul, do you have any good ones just off the top of your head?
Nah, I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
Paul does. You know he has some good ones. He just doesn't want to share them on the podcast.
Nothing that's appropriate for all audiences, I guess.
So if we start getting any emails from Raul Bobia,
yeah,
we know those are from you. All right.
So let's get into the news. I think Jesse, you wanted to kind of kick things off here.
Yeah, I did. I wanted to send out a special thank you to Jacob McQuaid. Him and I got together over email over the last couple weeks, or last 2 weeks rather, and he responded to a plea for help from me. To get the
mute button's right next to the record button.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. That kind of came out of nowhere. I apologize.
Yeah, way to screw up our thank you.
Sorry.
So Jacob, he helped me get the Google Maps version of the super huge detailed map of the Warhammer Old World back up and running. So we spent some time over the weekend together. We re-sliced up the most current version of the map, put it back up on the website. So the full screen version and the in-window browser one are both working. And we have a resource going forward to make sure that new iterations of the map will always stay up to date. So I'm thrilled. So hopefully you guys will all be able to benefit from that. And as a special thank you to him, I asked him, well, what can we do? Do you want to come on the podcast and say hi? Do you want me to pimp anything? And he said, you know what would really be fun? Who is that guy who did that British accent on the show?
God.
And I was like, I think it was Dan. And he says, well, you know, what if Dan gave me a thank you in his great British accent?
Oh.
And I said, well, yeah, that sounds fantastic, but it would be so much more fun if he just used his British accent for the whole first section of the podcast.
Oh my God. That's so going to be so hard. Do you know how hard that is to kind of keep that for a whole pod, for half a podcast?
All residents of the UK, please send your hate mail.
If I was to go for like 15 minutes and say thank you, Jacob McQuaid, I appreciate all of your help on the podcast.
See, that was Australian. That ain't even...
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. It's very hard for me. Like, if I'm pressured, I can't get it. I'll start veering off to like Australian.
We'll get you excited. And
perform, monkey. Perform.
Perform, monkey.
Well, Dan, why don't we start it off with a heartfelt thank you to Jacob McQuaid.
Okay, Jacob McQuaid, we appreciate all of your help. You know, here in Britain, we don't get that much assistance, especially with our good friend Jesse Burke. So, hey, Jacob, we really appreciate it. And, of course, you've helped us excel our podcast. So, thank you, Jacob McQuaid.
So bad.
I know. This is what happens. You create this
environment. You put them on the spot and it falls apart.
Yeah.
So, exactly. Let's put this train at least slightly back on the track. other news that we've got out there. So the big thing is we are recording this a day later, so we're actually a little more in sync with the release schedule of Fantasy Flight. And they've announced that Omens of War has actually shipped out to stores. So it is starting.
Dan, you saw it at your local store.
Jesse's going to slap me because, yeah, I literally had it in my hands. But then I knew that if I bought it, my girlfriend would slap me across the face. So I had the decision, Jesse slap me over the computer or my girlfriend.
I was so upset because I can't find it at any stores within 20 miles of me.
Yeah.
I have Dan sitting here looking at 8 copies.
No, there was 16 copies. Oh. I literally walked in, they had them there, and then they also had them on the bookshelf. So they look pretty cool, honestly. And actually, to kind of tell you that it looked like, I'm not sure if I can tell by the closet, but there was a vampire count, what do you call it? The Blood Knights?
Oh, the Blood Dragons.
Yeah, Blood Dragons. Yeah, there was one of them on the back cover. So,
oh, really?
Yep.
I read the podcast put up the forums had an unboxing contents review of what came in the box set. But I know we'll do an unboxing and a little bit of an informal introductory review on our next episode.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to get a hold of it. I'm in the same boat as Jesse.
I'm picking up Friday, I think.
Yeah, I've got you know, we didn't get it directly. We have to go through distributors, ordering, blah 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 blah. You know, it's a bit of a shame because I was really kind of looking forward to it. But we will definitely do a complete and full breakdown. Next episode, we'll probably dedicate the whole episode to Omens of War and Korn as well. So.
So speaking of that, do we in last Wednesday, as the press release from Fantasy Flight, they released some details on severe wounds. Do we want to cover those now, or do you want to kind of get into those when we kind of cover the product as a whole?
Yeah, let's just do the product as a whole. I mean, okay, you know, there's going to be people out there who already have access to it, so any of our speculations is you know, just that. It's speculation. So
awesome.
Calm down, Jesse.
Hey, I just wanted
Don't
to cover
boat,
it.
Jesse.
I wanted to let people. Was that British? I'm not sure.
That was an attempt to be British, but I don't know. You know, but
it's getting a little better. It's getting very sophisticated.
I'm telling you, once I'm not under pressure, it's a whole lot better.
It's getting way better.
First,
you were the roguish like Australian, and now you're the.
Well, see what happened was I watched Australia last night. So that's why the Australian.
You mean that 16-hour movie about horses and World War II? And
I had to go see that with my girlfriend. Oh, man, that was poor. Although now she wants to go see Water for Elephants. So
yes.
Pray for me.
I've been told I should see that too.
Ugh. Fortunately, I have a small child, so I don't get to see any movie.
Oh, I totally got to watch the kids.
All right.
Sorry, babe, can't go.
We've got some other things going along. So we're actually, you know, this thing has been going on for quite a few months now. We started back in January and we're still going strong. So we're kind of reaching a certain level of maturity.
We are getting dangerously close to 24 hours of content.
Yeah.
We almost have a day worth of podcast.
And we appreciate all of the downloads. It's been, you know, we don't necessarily, this is my only podcast, so I don't have a whole lot to compare it to, but I know that there are hundreds of people out there that check us out every time we put out some new content. So thank you all of you for the downloads. That's really kind of what keeps us going because we're all pretty much fame horse. So, but continuing along that, I know Jesse, you're doing some new graphics and logos and things like that for us.
Yeah, there's actually a lot going on actually this is a really heavy news week both internally for the podcast and externally for Fantasy Flight. So we'll probably spend a little bit of extra time in the news section on this episode. So in no particular order, the Reckless Dice, we registered recklessdice.com as well as the existing rorschach.recklessdice.net. So you can use either of those two to access the Reckless Dice podcast website. Additionally, I have been working on some new graphics. We were toying around with, I'd mentioned last episode that KublaCon, the San Francisco Bay Area huge gaming convention, is coming up at the end of May. And I was really hoping to make some shirts or something cool, some swag or something that we could bring. So I got it in my head to make a shirt over the last 2 weeks, and pulled it together and got my shirt in the mail the other day. So I made a new logo for the Reckless Dice, which isn't visible on the site yet, but I have made some super cool shirts and a new mini logo and then a full back logo, which look real slick. So I had a lot of fun with that. Additionally, as I got excited about getting the Google Maps version of the SchmottWow up and running again, I got it in my head that I should make it bigger again. So I began, about a week ago, I undertook the new project of the eSchmottWow, which is the extra super huge detailed map of the Warhammer Old World. And that one is actually increasing its size by roughly 240%. So it's over doubling in size, expanding up into Norska, filling out all the way to the pole, up into the Chaos Wastes, and going east all the way out to the edge of the Darklands, and then probably south to mid-Araby. Otherwise, I'm aligning it for a future expansion, which will align with the southern tip of Ulthuan. So once I finish this expansion, I will be able to head out all the way west and incorporate Ulthuan into the map.
Nice.
So you're keeping things at the same resolution. You're just expanding
it up. Yeah, the file size is crippling, but this is no longer a map that can be printed. I mean, it's a 4x4, sometimes 4.5x4.5 is about the largest that any printer can handle. I have that had been my restriction on the prior map. I'd attempted to keep it at that resolution. 300 DPI, 4.5 feet by 4.5 feet. Now it's still 300 DPI, but now it's 4.5. It's about 5 feet by 8 feet now. Oh. So it's way bigger.
So Jesse, what you tell me is you're going epic.
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 Epoch.
Epoch.
Did we mention that also that Dan, you set us up on Facebook too?
That's right. Unfortunately, right now we are on Facebook, which
.com/UK. Yeah.
Yes, .com/UK. Unfortunately, for all you Americans, you unfortunately won't be able to get us. But yet, if you go talk to Jacob McQuaid.
This is so bad.
Yeah, so bad. This is what happens. I need to stop. Yes, we're on Facebook. See, Jesse, look what you do. You're going to get me in trouble by Paul.
I think it already has 2 likes, doesn't it? It within its first minute of being live, 2 people liked it.
I think it's going to be a hit. So, everybody, it is on Facebook. And I think... talking with Paul and Jesse, I think we're going to really open this up. We're going to do a lot of polls. You guys can post photos. We'll have links to, new things coming out. It's going to be another great way to keep everybody up to date with things that are going on within the Reckless Dice podcast and crew.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm thrilled for that. We'll make sure we get that thing fully fleshed out over the next couple of days.
Yep.
Cool. All right. So anything else? What did we miss?
I got one more big thing that we've been talking about doing for a couple episodes now, and we've even toyed about it on the forums, is as a lot of you guys know, we do our sessions remotely when we play typically, and we use something called Map Tools, and then we use Skype for the voice communication. A lot of people, both as requests into the podcast and also communication on the forums, have asked kind of, hey, what is it? How do you do it? Don't really know how to get into it. And we toyed with the idea of doing an introductory session where we just kind of teach people how to use map tools and how to play remotely. And this Saturday, which is the 30th of April at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, which is Greenwich Mean Time minus 8, we will I'll be running a session. Not necessarily a game session, though we'll talk about a lot of game mechanics. We'll talk about how Map Tools works, how to operate it, how to set up games, how to join existing games, really just kind of how to get yourself around the tools and how to use the rule set that I worked on to kind of allow players to play remotely. So I'm going to try and maybe even record it so we can post it later on if anybody misses it. But we've had a pretty good response so far for people wanting to participate in that.
Very good.
So if you want to participate, either shoot the Reckless Dice at recklessdice@gmail.com an email, or go to the Fantasy Flight forums and you'll see a post about learning to play online and an introduction to map tools. You can post there as well. Additionally, you can just hit me up on Skype. My user ID is jburkedesign, J-B-U-R-K-E design, D-E-S-I-G-N, and I'll accept you and then we'll hook up that way.
Very good. So I think that does it for the news. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, our system spotlight will be all about damage. Our main topic is about Skaven, and then, of course, we still have some questions and answers. So,
what do you mean? The Skaven don't exist?
Hey, Jesse, can you get me some water?
Water?
Water.
Oh, all right. Feels now.
We'll take a quick break, and back on the other side, we'll talk about damage, like the damage I'm going to do to Dan.
The damage that's happening to your brain by listening to him talk.
Yes.
And we're back. So we're back with the system spotlight segment this time. Last episode, we did a super long Q&A and kind of cleared out the queue of that. So we're back to the kind of Warhammer 3rd Edition 101, where we look at particular a handful of mechanics that are all related. And hopefully we'll be covering all the mechanics of the system throughout the podcast. So this time around, we're going to focus on damage and one of the really nice things about Warhammer is that there's functions above and beyond just taking out hit points, and when you get it to zero hit points, you're in trouble. And specifically, the two that are used as much, if not more, than actually taking wounds and hits are fatigue and stress.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are used actually quite a bit more. I hand those out very liberally, and then...
Yes, you do.
Well, I think the game mechanics really, they want that, and it shows that the mental fatigue is, I think, almost more exciting than the physical damage that your characters take.
Yeah, and I don't think people really get into the whole aspect of how fatigued a character can be. I mean, honestly, if you were to be put in a situation where you're running around, you know, trying to create things, and you've got battles going on, you got people interacting, the stress and fatigue that you're going to encounter, I mean, that's something that not a lot of RPGs put into perspective.
Yeah, the hit point model classically and modern RPGs have changed that, but the hit point model classically is, I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm dead. You know, there's nothing in the middle.
Well, and let's cover real quick what do hit points mean to you, Paul? Because I for a long time when I was playing RPGs, hit points meant, you know, this is how much life I have or how much... You know I'm curious before I kind of give my thoughts on it. What is your definition of hit points? What do they mean?
So I think the important thing for specifically for Warhammer Fantasy,
or I guess maybe I should rephrase before you continue, is that what do wounds mean?
Yeah, exactly. In Warhammer 3rd Edition, because wounds and critical wounds go hand in hand, right? So if you remember in 2nd Edition, you didn't actually start taking critical wounds until you got down to zero hit points. Mm-hmm. In this edition, you can take the first hit can cause a critical wound. So in my mind, your wound threshold, which is the number of hit points that you can take before you get knocked out, takes into account damage. So regular wounds count as damage. It's just not specific. It's cuts and abrasions and, you know, bruising and things like that. So it is actual damage to your character.
So what you're saying is it's almost the wounds represent the non-permanent, but that's not necessarily the right phrase, but I'm going to roll with it. The wounds represent your non-permanent damage. Like you said, the cuts, the bruises, the things you can shrug off and keep fighting. And the critical wounds represent the actual physical effects that your character is receiving that actually have some kind of long-lasting effect to it.
Well, I think that I think the better term may be non-specific damage is what
like the little cuts and the little bruises, right, and the ows and the winded moments and the, you know, flexing blows and because every
like
wound
me running
you take
into a
does
wall.
Not mean you've been cut. It may just mean you're tired or you're getting fatigued, and when you pass that threshold, you're no longer able to deflect those blows, and you're, you know, starting to get hurt now.
Well, but again, you know, I don't. That's kind of the old ablative way of looking at damage. I really do believe that, you know, the modeling is such that you are taking damage. If you take damage, if you take wounds, you are taking damage. Some of that is unspecific, which is the general wounds against your wound threshold, and some of it is specific, which are the critical wounds and the severe wounds that we'll see in Omens of War. So That's really how I see it. Now, you kind of mixed some of the terms in there because there really isn't a hard link between fatigue and wounds. So once you receive the wounds that are equal to your wound threshold, you fall unconscious. You're knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
Fatigue and stress are different.
Now, fatigue represents your physical fortitude. And stress represents your mental fortitude,
yep,
or capacity.
So just how all of your statistics are broken up into physical and mental. So you have your strength, agility, and toughness are your physical. So you've got, it's actually very symmetrical. You have your offensive, your defensive, and your finesse characteristic for your physical, and then you have an offensive, defensive, and finesse characteristic for your mentals as well.
And then also, those are also colored red or orangey on your character sheet, and then blue,
right?
Red being your fatigue, and blue being your
physical,
your stress,
yeah,
or mental rather. Mm-hmm. And those also correspond to a lot of the tokens that you would use for those.
Right. So as
a lot
you,
of color coding going on there.
So your wound thresholds are up in the teens. You know, you usually have from like 12 to 15 starting characters have that around a wound threshold. For fatigue and stress, you start taking the effects of fatigue and stress when the amount of fatigue that you have is greater than one of your physical characteristics. So if you have a dump stat, say, you know, you have a dump stat of your, you know, say for some reason, you know, your fellowship dump stat is 2, and you take 3 stress, then your stress is over your
I hate when I take 3 stress from taking a dump. Mentally,
mental dump.
Well, no, wait. Now I have a question. So I know that some of the action cards, they can cause fatigue and stress.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
there's also the universal effect. 2 banes creates fatigue or stress, depending on whether the action was mental or physical. And 2 boons can revive fatigue.
So do you think that a lot of people who are running games, do they depend upon what type? Like, so let's say I was doing an action, and that action already gave 2 stress, and they felt that conducting that action in the manner that I described I was going to do it would gain more stress. Do you see that happening a lot, or?
Yeah, I like to see stress and fatigue as the way for a GM to, I'm struggling for the right word again, but maybe to influence or damage or hurt the characters or penalize them in a non-permanent physical way. You know, I can, like, you do something silly, you hurt yourself somehow, I can throw you an extra stress or an extra fatigue, or there's a whole variety of game mechanics that support dishing those out as well. But it's much easier to throw a fatigue point at a character than it is to make him suffer a wound.
And I think there's a differentiation there in my mind between story mode and encounter mode. If you're in story mode, then definitely fatigue and stress is kind of GM's fiat. You know, you're on a long trek. Gain 2 mm-hmm. fatigue, you know, it's raining out, you know, things like that are really more along the lines of the GM. When you get into encounter mode, you get out of story mode and you get into encounter mode, their fatigue and stress are built into so many of the mechanics and actions and the universal effect that's right there. I'd be a little careful about piling on additional fatigue and stress because of a GM's fiat in those cases. So there really is, you know, you've always got the universal effect, but for example, if you do more than one maneuver in a round, you know, that's an extra fatigue.
That is an option anybody can do every turn.
Yep.
You know, it's not just if you're forced to do one, you know, you can opt every turn to add an additional maneuver at the expense of a fatigue.
Yeah. If you want to change your stance more than your free change, that's additional stress. So there are multiple opportunities for your players to inflict fatigue and stress onto themselves when you're in encounter mode. So I don't, as a GM, really kind of force it down people's throats in that case.
No, even if you, like, let's say you were in a chaos warp and you're going through and you're in a certain situation, you wouldn't extend any stress or fatigue.
One thing you can do in situations like that where it's an extremely, tumultuous environment or stressful, or it's a heavy, heavy storm that just doesn't let up at all. It's like a constant effect. You can just force everybody to suffer fatigue and never let them recover that fatigue until that sequence is over. So you can force a permanent fatigue point or stress point, or even multiple points for that matter, as kind of the baseline minimum ability to recover. That's something you could do for, let's say, a heavy storm. While you're swimming rapids, maybe you can't recover any fatigue while you're doing that, and you're never going to get beyond you're never going to recover to a certain point, because you're never going to be fully healed or restored while you're still in that situation.
Yep.
Okay.
So I think, getting back to the effects on so we talked a lot about how you get fatigue, how you get stress. I think going back to the effects on that. So as I was going towards, whenever your stress is greater than any of your mental characteristics, then you take a misfortune die on all tests relating to that characteristic. So back to the example, if you have 3 stress and your fellowship is 2, if you're making a fellowship test, you're always adding 1 misfortune die to those rolls as long as you have 3 stress. If you have 4 stress, then you have 2 misfortune dice. Same thing happens on the physical side. So if you're swinging a sword, your strength's 4, but you've got 5 fatigue and you're swinging a sword. When you make your attack roll, that's going to be 1 misfortune die added to that roll. It gets a little complicated because you only pass out when your stress or fatigue becomes twice your defensive stat, more than twice your defensive stat. So fatigue is twice toughness plus 1, stress is twice willpower plus 1. But you're still affected. So you're still fatigued if you have more fatigue than any of your physical characteristics. You're still stressed if you have more stress than any of your mental characteristics. Mm-hmm. And if you're fatigued and stressed at the same time, that's another strained, status, right, where you become strained. And
place to be.
Because down the path of strained, every time you gain more fatigue or stress when you're in a strained mode, you start gaining temporary insanities. And temporary insanities can turn into permanent insanities.
And those temporary insanities come about, we'll probably cover insanities as a specific spotlight.
That'll be a new spotlight, yeah.
Yeah, but basically you're going to it's each time you take additional stress or fatigue, it's not so you can per act, if I remember correctly, you get 1 per act.
I'm sorry, what was that?
You can get up to 1 temporary insanity per act, or can you gain multiple per act?
Oh, no, you get, I believe you get insanity every time.
We'll make sure and do that one soon, because I know we're going to get another set of maybe even some more insanities as we get these next expansions out. Hopefully we'll see some new some insanities and some mutations in the Omens of War. So we'll review that in our next episode.
Yep.
Now I have a question. Do you guys ever see people really push the threshold where you as a GM have to step in and initiate kind of the stuff that you're talking about?
I mean, I had a lot of warriors who push themselves far into the reckless stance and then just go balls out when they're fighting. And they push those extra maneuvers. They do all the things that they kind of push it to the limit, and then all of a sudden realize only at the beginning of combat that they've already put themselves several fatigue points in. And then as that combat draws out over 3 or 4 rounds, they continue to gather fatigue points. And yeah, I had a couple characters pass out.
Wow. Yeah, all the way to passing out.
I did. Yeah, on my first 2 sessions, I had 2 guys, 1 warrior pass out 2 times. He didn't quite learn how to manage his reckless stance well enough until he passed out a few times and realized that he really needed to play it a little more intelligently and couldn't move that meter all the way.
Now, when we talk about fatigue and stress recovery, so you're supposed to be gaining fatigue and stress pretty quickly. As we mentioned in the encounter mode, there's a lot of effects that will generate fatigue and stress. You can also remove it pretty quickly. Assess the situation, one of the basic actions that everybody gets. If you are successful with your test for assess the situation, which is just a straight up intuition check and intelligence check, you regain one fatigue and one stress as you kind of take a break, gather your wits about yourself and look at what's going on with the current encounter.
I'd suggest that's a very underutilized action card, especially for new players. That's one that most players who have played a few rounds are used to using, and using that to control their fatigue like you're describing, but new players will often overlook it.
Well, and it's not even – I mean, there's an additional benefit as well, is that if you're successful with it, all attacks against you get an extra misfortune die. So it's
almost like blocking.
Exactly. It gets you the same benefit as blocking, and you regain a fatigue or stress.
Yeah, we have a question about something similar to that later on. Yeah. I'll have to get into that.
So fatigue and stress are definitely unique to Warhammer, or pretty unique to Warhammer 3rd edition, and it's a great addition to it. Like we said, you know, it gets rid of that idea of I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm dead that you get from the classic hit points. But then you get into the wounds, and we kind of already talked about that and touched on that. Wounds and critical wounds happen all at the same time. The difference when you're talking about your wound threshold and whether you're knocked out or not is no different between wounds and critical wounds. So if you have 3 critical wounds and 5 regular wounds, then that knocks your 8 into your wound threshold.
Right, representing, like, you know, when you normally get a wound, you have the face down of the card with the slash marks on the back.
Right.
And then when you get a critical wound, you turn it over to reveal what the effects of that particular wound are. So it still counts as a card.
Right.
Each card represents a wound, whether it's a critical or a regular wound.
So that's what you're kind of going off of. I mean, I remember, Jesse, when we played, I kind of was getting a little cocky, I guess you could say, and man, I was getting all those wound counters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got quite a stack a couple times, yeah.
Yeah. Now, what would be a good thing for, you know, I mean, since we're really kind of diving deep into this, how would you advise people to really manage? I mean, because sometimes people probably don't look at the amount of wound cards that they have, and they go full bore thinking, you know, it's not until you start dishing them out that they're like, oh, I'm over.
Right, you know? When all of a sudden you're getting dealt 3, 4, 5 wounds at a time, and your character only has 12 or 11, you know,
exactly.
Wound threshold, you know, that's 2, 3 solid hits against you, and you're going to be in deep trouble.
So what would you guys recommend for someone, you know, before they, you know, because there are some people that get very, very anxious when they play. I mean, if they're getting ready to kill something, they don't think twice, you know.
I think it's a positive effect of the game. You know, it's a learning curve where you realize that it's a role-playing game where you are not a superhero. It's one where you will get hurt, and you will get hurt badly, and this is going to be even more fun when these severe wounds come out, where, you know, there are long-lasting effects to stupid decisions. And it's fun to experience getting your ass kicked and survive and having to go through the healing process and struggle with it. That creates a really cool gaming experience.
And I think tactically what you can do is you can encourage defensive play. So that kind of assess the situation, guarded position, those kind of basic defensive actions that you can start throwing in there as well. Especially if, you know, your combat-focused characters are going to have their go-to attack card. And that go-to attack card is potentially not going to be available every turn. So instead of, you know, using your go-to attack card and then waiting 2 rounds as the recharge refreshes, and you're just using basic melee attacks during that time, throw in a guarded position, you know, play defense until your big hit recharges, and then bring it back out.
Yeah, certainly. So I know we're gonna get into critical wounds in a second, because wounds,
yep,
as themselves, they're pretty straightforward.
Yep.
But the critical wounds, there's a lot of confusion or different ways to potentially interpret the way those rules are written. And I even know myself, I have a couple questions and clarifications I'd like to get from the two of you as we kind of get into this topic. So, you know, maybe Paul, why don't you kick us off on critical
wounds? Yeah. So the important part is that the way that wounds and damage is calculated is that you take all of the damage effects. So the numerical damage effects. So the base damage potential, as it's called in the rules, is if it's a melee attack, it's your strength plus the damage rating of your weapon. If it's a ranged attack, it's your agility plus the damage rating of your weapon. If it's a monster, the monster is just going to have a straight up attack number as well. That's takes all of that into account.
Yeah, typically they'll have their strength rating and then a number in parentheses, and the number in parentheses represents their
damage rating.
Their representative damage rating. So whether it's claws, swords, whatever, that's their damage rating.
Or if it's a ranged, you know, it's the agility plus that attack. So for PCs, you're going to have damage rating of the weapon that you're using. For NPCs and monsters, you're going to have the attack, which is the damage rating of whatever they're using. It isn't specified. You can if you want to, and that's a way that you can specify your monsters by giving them a particular weapon, but it's all kind of put in there that you don't have to keep track of it if you don't want to. So, and then any effects that are cumulative to that, anything that's added onto it. So anything.
Do you have a hard time with that word?
Yeah. Anything that's like a plus one damage, plus two damage, plus one wounds, plus two wounds, that goes on top of that damage potential, and you get that overall damage potential number. Note.
Now, Paul, I have a question off the top of your head. How many exact – because I know that there's more critical – or there's very few critical wounds, and Jesse, you were kind of going further into the – worse wounds that are going to be coming out.
The severe ones, yeah.
The severe. How many critical wounds are in the deck that you get?
As many.
There's a load. There's like every release that's come out so far has added anywhere between like 5, 10, even 20 additional cards to your wound deck. So the wound card deck right now is probably a couple inches tall.
Okay.
So we're probably looking at something like 100-ish cards. And then every new release continues to add to that. So it's really a matter of whatever your GM has, and it could fluctuate from player to player based on what expansions they have.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it takes up a full 2 pages in the Game Master's Guide.
And mind you, there are a lot of duplicates of different severity levels. Like you might have a ruptured spleen severity level 2, severity level 3, and severity level 4 might be three different cards, even though they're all the same specific wound. So there are several duplicates. I don't know if those are covered specifically in the tables.
Yeah, they are. They absolutely are. So going back to the damage calculation, so critical wounds does not factor into damage potential. So if you have an effect that says plus one critical, or this attack does critical damage, it does not affect your damage potential. Your damage potential is still your characteristic plus your weapon plus any bonuses, any numerical bonuses that you get. So you calculate your damage potential, you calculate the damage reduction, which is your toughness plus your soak. And the soak can come from armor and effects and things like that. And then you reduce the damage reduction from the damage potential, and that's the damage that's left over that's done to you. Once you have the actual damage that's left over and done to you, now you bring in the criticals. So, for example, you know, you start out with 10 damage, and your damage reduction is 7. So you wind up with 3 wounds. Now you come in and see that, all right, I've got a plus one critical, so that means I take 2 regular wounds and 1 critical wound.
Mm-hmm. Now let's not forget the more standard way to generate a critical wound, which is every weapon has a critical rating. Typically it's like a 2, a 3, or maybe even a 4. And the lower the number, the better chance of generating that critical. Because what that number means is that's how many boons you need to generate in your roll in order to trigger a critical wound.
Yep.
So, you know, a great weapon, or it's a hand weapon, the standard weapon everybody uses, there's a critical weighting of 3. So you need to have 3 excess boons in your dice pool at the end of an attack, and you can trigger a critical effect, even if your weapon doesn't have something like a +1 critical, for example.
Or the action that you did has an effect of +1 critical.
Right, and like a great weapon, I think, has a critical rating of 2. So you only need 2 boons to get that critical hit. Which brings me to a question for you guys. That makes what I just described there makes perfect sense from a player's perspective. Okay, players roll dice. They have the weapon in their hand. They know what their critical rating is. They make their attacks. They generate extra criticals. They throw them on PCs. Everybody's happy. Now, what happens? NPCs, creatures, monsters, goblins, orcs. They don't have a critical rating on their roster. Well, how do they generate criticals on PCs?
So there's 2 ways that you can do that. One is through the actions that they have. So the monster actions kind of take into account critical damage. And my belief is that the designers have made it that way. But there is the ability.
Because nobody cares about criticals on an orc. They want we all care about criticals on our characters.
Well, but that's not necessarily correct. I mean, so critical damage in the rules as written, critical damage counts for everything. It counts for nemesis level NPCs and normal level NPCs.
Do you put criticals on your non-henchmen, like generic orcs?
Yeah, the non-minions?
Yeah.
Absolutely, because those affect the capabilities of that monster. So, again, it's all back to that, you know, I hit him, I hit him, I hit him, I hit him, nothing happens. I hit him, I hit him, I hit him, I hit him, they fall over dead.
Mm-hmm.
By injecting critical wounds into that, the part where I'm hitting him a bunch, but I'm not doing anything, right? That's one of the tropes of Warhammer. So I always hit him, but I do shit for damage, so I've got to hit him 50 times. If you throw in a critical, you're affecting them immediately. So
you're essentially saying that you could potentially pass the critical threshold prior to hitting his wound threshold.
No, there's no critical threshold.
Sure there is. If you have more criticals than you do toughness, you die.
Nope. Only if your wound threshold is 0.
Oh, both those criteria have to be met?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, I was not aware of that.
Yeah, so you can take a bajillion criticals. Just don't run out of wounds, because then you'll die as soon as you run out of wounds. So that is an effect, so that, you know, you're fighting a dragon, you're plinking against him, you're doing 1 or 2 points of damage, because the guy's got a soak value up in the stratosphere. If you're doing those 1 or 2 points of damage, but you're doing critical wounds on it, remember, criticals come in after damage reduction is done.
So you could do the 1 minimum point and then plus an extra 3 for the severity rating of the critical.
No. So, sorry. The 1 minimum is never a critical. So there's a rule that if you hit, but the damage reduction takes away all of your damage, you still do 1 wound. That 1 wound is only a normal wound.
So you would, in theory, then do 2. You do 1 normal and 1 critical?
No. So
I'm lost.
Yeah. So if the damage reduction is greater than the damage potential, then you do 1 normal wound, full stop. Doesn't matter what other effects you have or anything like that.
Okay.
All right. If you do 1 point of damage, if your damage potential is 1 greater than your damage reduction, mm-hmm. criticals can go on to that. So you can turn that 1 normal wound into a critical wound if you have a critical wound effect in play.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you're hitting that dragon and you're only doing 1 point of damage because he's got a damage reduction that's way up there,
You still got to hit him 40 times.
But every time you hit him, if you're activating that critical capability, you're doing critical damage to him, and
some negative effects.
Exactly. That has a negative effect, a cumulative negative effect on that monster.
So, okay, I am with you.
Yeah.
I'm learning how to play this game.
Yeah. So
you're like me, Jesse, in the beginning.
So it's really getting out of that second edition mind frame where it's
Have you guys heard about this game, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition? It's awesome.
Where it's that
we should play sometime.
Hit, 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 and then you start doing critical wounds. You want to do critical wounds right off the bat. You want to be piling those critical wounds onto those monsters right off the bat. It's really an effective way, and it's one of those ways where they're trying to encourage you, you know, that idea that, well, I always just hit. And I do a certain number of damage, and that's boring. Well, you shouldn't be doing that. I mean, sure, it's easy for you to hit. How easy for it is you to hit and do critical damage? Because then you're really going to get something going in the early rounds of the combat, not just towards the end where everybody's down to, you know, a few left in their wound threshold.
Sure. So yeah. when you take, so you mentioned that you need to take wounds up to your wound threshold, in addition to having a number of critical wounds equal to your toughness in order to actually die. Not just get knocked out and have someone come and slit your throat, but actually die from the wound that you received.
So the general rule is it's always hit your threshold plus one. So you have to take more wounds than your threshold. So if your threshold's
at your threshold is not knocked out. Your threshold is knocked out.
Exactly. So you have to be knocked out. So if you have a wound threshold of 13, when you have 14 wounds, you're knocked out. And then you have to have a number of critical wounds, one greater than your toughness. So if you've got a toughness
of 13, hop in here, and I need to ask my question that I brought. This was the question I submitted formally to myself for this podcast, for this episode. All right.
Oh, and you get to go to the front of the line? Is that?
I do. I'm going to actually jump this before the Q&A section because it was submitted directly to me by myself. There's a part of this process that confuses me, and I'm hoping it confuses some other people too, and we can provide some clarity. If let's say I've got 9 wounds, and my threshold's 10,
mm-hmm.
and let's even say I don't have any criticals going, and I take damage, and I take 4 wounds worth of damage. Mind you, I'm not at 9, my threshold's 10. And I'm now about to suffer 4 wounds. How does that get handled? So if it's my understanding that, of course, you take the 1, brings you to the threshold.
Mm-hmm.
You take an additional 1, which takes you beyond the threshold. You're therefore knocked out.
Right.
But if I read the rules correctly, wounds you take beyond your threshold are converted to critical wounds.
Let me check and make absolutely sure.
Now, my question is it each wound beyond your threshold, or is it just one wound once you pass? So does that mean I would take one additional do I take one additional, or do I take 2 additional?
Yeah, you will take – my understanding of the rules is that you will take one – so the wounds that affect you – once you're past your threshold, you get those as soon as a character is knocked unconscious in this manner, his player randomly selects one of the character's normal wounds and turns it face up, converting it to a critical wound.
So that just says a wound. So that means that means if I'm unconscious and a goblin comes over and stabs me, and he does damage, I automatically take one critical wound. So he has to stab me 4 more times from a hardcore rules perspective to kill me. Because each time he stabs me can only be one critical wound.
But at that point, right?
Is that where the GM kind of hops in and maybe just says, hey, look, the goblin comes over, you're unconscious, he decides he wants to kill you.
Slit your throat or something
right,
like
which
that.
Which one of our poor fellows found out in session 3.
the
wasn't me.
No, it wasn't you. I couldn't justify any other way to keep him alive because he was unconscious. The cultists had just downed him, and he wanted to kill him.
Well, was he? I mean, was he on his own? I mean, was
he? He was. He was on his own. There was nobody else to defend him. It was really just the cultist could just decide whatever he wanted to do with him. So he decided to kill him. And as ruthless as it was, it made sense.
You have no other avenue to allow the player to stay alive. I mean, come on.
That's kind of where I went with it. Exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I'd love to let you live, but dude, there's no reason this guy will allow it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like the goblin's going to get a heart of fate and be like,
I'd like to hear the listener's perspective on this particular rule and how some other people handle it. If you have house rules for it, or if you have a little more clarification for it, I'd love to hear it. But you know, Paul, I know we're going to be talking about Skaven soon. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to that.
Yep. No, I think we're done. I think we've beat this topic to death.
To death? Did it? Are you saying it passed its wound threshold?
Yes. So we have passed the wound threshold.
Not only
this
that,
topic,
but it suffered enough critical wounds.
So we're gonna
let me beat it to death a little more.
we're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, we're gonna talk about the myth of the Skaven. We're back. This time for the main topic, we're going to talk about the Skaven. So these are kind of one of the enemies within. They're not as overt as say Chaos is, or as in your face as say Orcs are, or Beastmen, or things like that. But Skaven is really one of those kind of unique adversaries in the Warhammer world, and there is a lot of fans, I guess, of the
Skaven. Are interesting that they tend to be one of the races in the Skaven, unlike any other race, span the whole world.
Exactly,
the whole Warhammer world, Skaven are present, and they live in something called the Underworld. Maybe we'll start on the most basic level. Skaven are, lack of a better term, rat men, or kind of like these anthropomorphic rat creatures. You know, they're about the same height as a man who's crunched over. They walk on two legs, sometimes four. And they are, they're pretty much synonymous with a rat. I mean, they live in like a huge clan-based society. They are, and the Empire as a whole almost refuses to acknowledge their existence. Now, a lot of the other races in the Empire world know them very well. The elves, the dwarves, you know, they're fully aware of their existence and battle them on a daily basis sometimes. But the Empire really has kind of pushed them back into a kind of a folklore or this thing that people talk about, but nobody really agrees really exists.
Yeah. Well, and I think one thing that you should also say is there's four distinct clans that are really well known throughout the old world, especially including in the Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that of course there's Clan Mulder, Clan Pestilence, Clan Ishin, and Clan Sirene.
So I think it's Skryer.
And the
one of the interesting things about Skaven is particular to those clans you're mentioning. The Skaven have a, I mentioned this kind of clan-based society, but they also have a very particular allegiance to the number 13. And the significance of the number 13 kind of transcends down into their culture, where the higher ups of their Skaven culture have a this room down at the bottom of Skaven Blight, which is down kind of south of Bretonnia, and that's the capital of the biggest city of Skaven. And in Skaven Blight, they have the Council of 13, the kind of their elders or their leaders, and they have these the 13th Sea. It's kind of in this like horseshoe shape, and it's all around this giant pyramid of warp stone. And the Skaven are famous for consuming warp stone, using in their weapons, using in their magic, essentially forcing these rat men to consume this like chaos energy and rock form to kind of get their powers. And this 13th seat at the center, the bottom of the horseshoe, is the seat of the horned rat. The horned rat is kind of their fictitious god, or the being that they worship. And this is kind of thought to be maybe a chaos deity, or maybe even just one of the lesser chaos gods. It's a little unknown. Do you guys have any thoughts on kind of who the horned one is?
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Paul.
It's actually interesting. One of the cool board games that Warhammer in the Warhammer world is Chaos in the Old World, mm-hmm. Where you play as the bad guys, and it's, you know, who Nurgle, Slaanesh, Khorne, or Tzeentch is going to take over the Old World. And it's not so much fighting against the forces of the Old World as fighting against each other and who gets there first. Mm-hmm. They just came out with a expansion for it, and it's the Horned Rat, so it actually adds
so that
a fifth
definitely
player.
Fits into the playing, the style here. It's a little ambiguous I think purposefully so, as to the mythical culture of the Skaven, as to whether and who the Horned Rat really is. In the tabletop games, in some of the prior editions, you could actually field the Great Horned Rat, similar to a greater demon of chaos, on the battlefield. And so that kind of led to the belief that he was one of the maybe lesser chaos gods. Really hard to say now. But but back to your point, Dan, where you were mentioning all these different clans, this horseshoe seat of elders, the remaining 12 seats are all essentially the leaders of different houses or different clans within the Skaven Empire. The four you mentioned are four of the most prominent ones. We know those ones because they're often featured in the Warhammer tabletop game. Clan Mulder is very famous for having experimenting with different creatures, patching different monsters together. Yeah, like rat ogres. Certainly a lot of Taming the Beasts.
They're the more mad scientists when it comes to Warpstone. I mean,
like Frankenstein. I mean, they're the epitome
exactly.
of Frankenstein.
They like to breed all sorts of monstrous beasts for war. They're
famous for their pack masters.
Exactly.
The rat swarms, giant rats, rat ogres, rat. What's that new crazy contraption they put out for the tabletop game?
Oh,
the behemoth of a thing.
Yeah, it's the I think
it's the Doom Wheel. It's the hamster wheel, isn't it?
No, but if you give me a sec, I can figure out what
well,
it is.
While
keep,
you
keep
while you
going,
while you
I figure
find
it
that
out.
The one of the other major clans, Clan Pestilence, which you had mentioned, has a particular allegiance to Nurgle as well as the Warpstone and the Skaven culture. So they deal a lot with disease, pestilence. Censor bearers, poison wind globadiers, things like that. Actually, I'm sorry, poison wind globadiers are part of Clan Scryer, but they a lot of the technologies that the different clans tend to build together do often overlap. Now, Clan Scryer is more the mechanically inventive one. They have the things like the warplock Jazales, they have warp fire throwers, they have the lightning cannons, the warp lightning cannon, the poison wind globadiers. They kind
the
of
Jazales, yeah.
The Jazales. So a lot often what will happen, Skaven will basically steal and scavenge materials from the surface world, and they will take that technology back downstairs into the underworld and rework it, turn it into some crazy killing machine, and then bring it to war with them.
Yeah. Now I got you the name of it. It's called the Skaven Hellpit Abomination.
Yes, that sounds very
And it says, a withering mass of muscle, bone, and mechanical components, the Hellpit Abomination is a living mountain of misshapen flesh that towers over the battlefield below, ready to crush and tear and devour anything in its path. That would be a really cool monstrous creature to have.
So the Hellpit, in case any of you guys are curious, I mentioned Skavenblight, which is the capital. The Hellpit is up north near Kislev. You guys can find it on the Schmottwow if you want to check out where it is. It has a big old Skaven icon on it. So it is there. One of the last of the major Skaven culture clans is Clan Eshin, which is synonymous with assassins, sneaking, gutter runners, the Skaven assassins.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all things you'd find within that realm. A lot of poisons, a lot of subterfuge.
Well, these are pretty much the ones that are sent out to do the nasty stuff. They also, I mean, Clan Eshin is very well known to attack within its own, you know, the hierarchy. They'll go after each other. You know,
oh, absolutely. That actually brings it to a good point in that the Skaven culture is purely based on deceit, sneaking, conniving, selfish, cowardly, backstabbing, pretty much any trait you would associate with a rat. And the funny thing is they have all those traits. And pretty much all the negative traits of humanity without any of the good ones.
It's Darwin gone bad.
But what's interesting is that the Skaven, they take all those bad traits. They don't have any of the good ones. They just those good ones don't exist. It's not that they're few and far between. They don't exist. Skaven do not know love. They do not know loyalty. They do not know friendship. None of those things exist in their culture at all.
I mean, even if you get, I mean, into the tabletop, I'm not sure if you know, we'll ever see them in here, but you have the slaves. They'll put, you know, they capture during civil wars that they have, they'll capture, you know, their own kind and force them into battle in front of everything else and not care.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
you know?
Skaven slaves are actually in the Creature's Guide. So that is an aspect of it. And I think that's important. I mean, one of the one of the themes of the Warhammer world is that civilization and the good guys are holding on by a thread. And the only reason that we haven't been, you know, completely lost to darkness is because all the bad guys not only fight us, but they fight amongst each other. So Skaven are at that continuous civil war. The clans are always fighting for one-upsmanship over each other. That they've got this complete pack mentality where somebody's either your boss or you're subservient to them. There's no such thing as a peer in Skaven culture. They're always fighting for domination, even within their own clans, let alone the clans fighting the other clans and things like that. And it's only when you get the strongest enough people or the strongest enough groups or clans or things like that, do they say, okay, now let's go take on the humans. Kind of like how orcs, where they squabble amongst themselves until there's a strong enough leader. Starts up the WA, and then, you know, the green tide comes over, you know, whatever.
You know, it's interesting you say that, where the Council of 13 regularly changes seats because different members of the council are murdering each other in order to, you know, or other people who are on a lower rung are trying to get up there. But what's also interesting that you brought up is that it's often believed from a world in the Empire and the Warhammer world as a whole, that the Skaven have the numbers easily to take over the world. They could do it whenever they wanted to. But the problem is they are never organized enough. They're always infighting to such a degree that the likelihood of them ever being able to pull that off is really next to impossible. But they do have that amount of numbers.
They have a large presence unfortunately, you know, they're like the cockroaches here. You know, if there was a mass war, the planet goes out, the Skaven would be the ones to survive everything because they're massed.
They live in the underworld.
Yeah, exactly.
But the Skaven males tend to be, you know, slaves, warriors, like you guys were saying. But one thing I found that was really fun and interesting was that the females, you know, they're pretty much they live to breed, you know, and they'll just like any female rat. But the funny thing is that they are so much larger, and they're almost like a bug queen, like an ant queen. You know, the Skaven females in the lair are almost incapable of moving and surviving on their own. They have to be fed by the other rats. They're like 10 feet tall, fat and grotesque, and they're guarded by these black-haired storm vermin eunuchs who actually just kind of keep them alive. But each female produces about 100 Skaven a year to add to the tides of war. So I thought that was just a kick. You could picture some cool adventures trying to go in and try and take down a Skaven female breeder. That could be a cool one.
That would be really cool. I'd just be a rat catcher. I'd catch them all.
You know, one of the other fun things I thought about the Skaven culture, which is very important, is the color of the fur. Color of Skaven fur is a really big thing in their culture. The brown fur is your kind of more average Skaven. That's what you're going to find when you find any creature. The white and gray colored Skaven are very, very prized among their culture because those tend to be the ones that they will push into the Greyseer position, which is the Skaven version of a shaman or a wizard, and they will consume the warp stone, learn to cast spells and whatnot. So those kind of albino Skaven will tend to be wizards.
And then the black.
Additionally, the black ones, right, which I'd mentioned, the storm vermin. The black ones are seen as kind of the sign of a true killer or an elite Skaven, and those will be pushed into the elite ranks of fighters, called storm vermin.
The storm vermin, I mean, to go on a little further, they are the elite of the elite. I mean, they're like the Navy SEALs of our current military.
Let's put it this way. They actually get armor.
Yes, but they're well armored. If any of you guys have ever played the game, they're the most well structured. They don't break as easily. They are a little bit larger than the other rats, but also it's that hierarchy. When the storm vermin are in a battle, just like if you go back to Napoleon days, the old guard, whenever you defeat an enemy, the storm vermin are always the first ones to go in. They get what they want, they leave. same thing, you know, and then whatever's left over goes to whatever, you know, whoever's left.
Sure,
absolutely. But that's that hierarchy that's really established with the Storm Vermin, I think, is really cool when you look at Skaven. I mean, they do have some military tacticians within there, but yet again, they always fight each other, so wouldn't be surprised if some guy didn't get stabbed. So.
Well, and I think that's an important part tactically when you're talking about encounters with Skaven. Unless they have numbers, they're never going to do a straight up fight. They're always going to be hiding in the shadows. You know, you may run up against a certain one or two individual Skaven if they are the assassin, you know, type or storm
gutter
vermin.
Runners. The gutter runner.
Right. Yeah. The gutter runners or the storm vermin are really the only single Skaven that you're going to find. They're really designed to be that packway. If you find a single Skaven and it's not like a Gracier or a gutter runner or a storm vermin, that guy's going to be freaked out of his mind, and,
exactly.
And he's going to cower, he's going to run, he's going to flee. So it's really is a matter of they're a little bit glass cannon. They'll hit you, but they don't take any hits back.
Mm-hmm. They'll flee at the first chance of them not surviving.
Yeah.
But I think that pretty much wraps up the Skaven. I mean, they're a very interesting race. The one last thing we kind of touched on from the very beginning, general Empire folk, even when presented with irrefutable evidence that the Skaven exist, will often disavow the fact that they even are part of the world. Often Skaven are confused or mistaken for a Beastmen. And that's kind of your typical, like, oh, it must be just one of the Beastmen. The Skaven are very real, but when you're playing games, you can totally play up this thing where the Skaven are this mythical creature that may or may not even exist.
It's a little bit of the dark humor that goes throughout Warhammer, you know, how the orcs are soccer hooligans and the goblins are played up for comedic relief. That whole idea that the Empire has this blind spot around the Skaven can really be milked for some comedic value.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Plus their names are pretty comedic.
Well, and they're
Queek.
Well, and their way of talking, right? So they repeat words.
The
fast fast kill kill. That's how they do emphasis.
They do speak common or English or whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or they can rather.
Reichland, yeah. Reichspiel.
Reichspiel. Thank you. Yeah, if you ever want to hear them speak, pull up maybe some the Dark Omen computer game, or what other ones did they speak in? Maybe a little bit in the Warhammer Online game.
Way back when PlayStation, the first one that came out, there was a...
Shadow of the Horned Rat.
Shadow of the Horned Rat, yep.
Yeah.
All right, so that'll do it for our main topic. We'll take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll do a couple of questions.
As always, you can submit your questions to recklessdice@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @recklessdice. Furlong Doug emails us, how are you handling your class in the game? I tried to incorporate a tire and the tier into the game either by a plus or minus fortune or misfortune dice. Recently, one of my players said in character, we should talk to Adler, but I have to get some better threads first. So that's great. I think that he's referring to the Gathering Storm talking to the his characters were going to go and talk to is it the Burgomeister or
yep.
is it the
it's the Burgomeister
yeah of Stromdorf, and you know the class is a really subtle thing that you can incorporate into your game that I think is often overlooked.
Some of the careers in the game are kind of lead you towards a class. Rat catchers
what we're
are
talking about is the brass, the silver, and the gold
right.
classes.
And that actually, one of the really cool things that I like about Warhammer 3rd is that they align the class with the economy. The brass tier is named the brass tier because that's what they deal with. They deal with brass. Actually, receiving a silver shilling would be something unique and weird for them to have. Mm-hmm. And they'd never ever see a gold crown. So
basically, what you're saying is that the different income levels of different characters do represent their class. So you know, the peasants deal with the brass, the merchants deal with silver, the gold class or the
nobility
the nobility deal with gold. And typically what you'd want to see is that how the rules spell it out is when you're dealing with a class lower than you, typically you'll have a fortune die, unless maybe they're disdainful of you, in which case you'd have a misfortune die. But you know, he's asking, you know, how do we handle it in some of the games that we've done? And I think the way he outlined it is exactly how I've handled it, where you just kind of throw in that extra fortune or misfortune die based on kind of what that relationship would be, whether that your peasants are groveling at a merchant, or maybe if you're a merchant and you have very loyal peasants, maybe you actually gain that fortune die as opposed to a misfortune die.
And I, you know, the way that I do it in my games, and you guys may remember from when we did the Gathering Storm, is that during character creation or at the
Which
first
nobody's
session
heard yet.
Oh yeah, we got to get that out there. during character creation, I asked my players, "Are you guys defined? Do you define yourselves as one of the tiers, brass, silver, or gold?" One of the things that adventurers do, and they even have it written in some of the fluff with the materials that are out there, is that adventurers don't necessarily fit into a tier, and that freaks people out. I mean, it's like, okay, you know, I'm a noble, I'm in the gold tier, I understand my status in life. This guy, he's not a noble, but he did, you know, stop the orc hordes. So is he my peer or is he not? You know, that sort of stuff. So there's a potential for adventurers to cross tiers.
There is. I think generally speaking, wouldn't you think that generally adventurers would be somewhere kind of bridging the gap between the brass and the silver tier?
No, I really think it depends on the role playing side of things. I mean, if you want to do that, you know, if you want to play that up, and again, some careers are aligned more than others, right? Ratcatcher is always going to be in the brass tier. The noble guys or the envoys, you know, they're going to be more in the silver or the gold tier. But that's really the opportunity for role playing to see is how they want to participate in that. You know, you take the Ratcatcher and put him in the ball at Edge of Night. How does that work out? There's a lot of opportunity for good role playing around that kind of class, as Furlong Doug showed with the, you know, we should go talk to Adler, but we need to go get new clothes and clean ourselves up.
Yeah, I thought that was great. So Jesse Emerson, also known as Evil Jesse, emails in, "I'm sure this isn't a new topic for experienced third edition GMs like ourselves." Oh, thank you. "But how do you guys plan on adjusting your games as the mountains of cards and rules pile up? Are you going to just include it all and deal with the somewhat inelegant statistical balance, or will you adjust the quantity of cards you use via random or deck building techniques?" Which I hadn't really considered prior to reading this this email, but you know, like I, the first thing that comes to my mind is the wound decks. You know, we are now presented with this mountain of cards for wounds and critical wounds, and now severe wounds. Are we going to you know, kind of start customizing or trimming the decks of these random cards to kind of tailor our games? Or are we just going to kind of use the big old honking stack of cards at any given point?
Well, and I think the important distinction there is talking about the decks, right? So the specific decks of cards that you have, the disease, insanity, miscast, mutation, and wound decks, right?
Mm-hmm.
From my perspective, the more the merrier. I'm going to keep them all, and I'm going to throw them all in there. And that's actually, you know, when we talked about organization, one of our questions from last episode, the decks I keep as decks. I don't take my decks and put them in the three ring binders. Those things that, you know, we're never going to shuffle through and pick stuff out, but those randomly generated effects and things like that. I just keep them together in a little box or rubber bands. Rubber bands are bad, or you know, whatever, you know, twist ties or whatever, and I just store the decks as decks, and the more the merrier, you know, throw them in there.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, one, depending on how many expansions you have, like let's say you own Omens of War, but you don't own a couple of the other expansions, your characters, your PCs may have a higher percentage chance then of generating one of those severe wounds because you don't have the added benefit of those extra 20 or 30 cards to add to your wound deck, or you might have a better chance of generating a Khorne mutation than you would a Nurgle mutation because of
you know, what supplements you have. But I think that's really not going to cripple your game in any way. I think it's really going to remain still very random, and it'll be fun.
Now, I think from the other aspect of things, and we talked about that a little bit last episode as well, is that as the GM and you're preparing for your adventure, that is where you pare down the cards. So you take out the monster cards that you're going to be using for that session. You take out the corresponding actions for those monsters. You take out the, you know, the appropriate, if you're using the if you're using the group cards for the monsters, things like that.
You know if you're focusing that adventure on Nurgle, for example, you may want to take out Zinch, Slaanesh, and Khorne mutations from your deck.
But I guess I'm going beyond the deck side of things, right?
I just want to kind of fold that in there, where if you wanted to start tailoring those random ones, not so much the ones to help you kind of organize your adventure, that's the kind of stuff you might want to do that's appropriate. The mutations are really the only ones I'm seeing that you would ever want to tailor as far as the random decks are concerned.
Yeah.
But going back to like the action cards and the monster cards and stuff like that, you know, I'm not leafing through my three ring binder when I'm running a game. I've got those in front of me or in hand or behind the GM screen already pulled out and already ready to go.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, that's it for questions for this week.
Cool. So I think we'll just wrap it up. So for this episode of Reckless Dice, we'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode, which will be all about Omens of War. Be sure to give us comments on our site, recklessdice.com or recklessdice.rorschach.net. Send us an email at recklessdice@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter @recklessdice. Check out our Facebook page. Search for Reckless Dice. You get the idea of who we are by now, right, guys? And please, you know, give us reviews. Let us know you're out there. Let us know how we can change our podcast to make it better and more enjoyable for you.
And most importantly, we need your guys' suggestions for an effective name.
A new handle. Yeah.
I think I've already given them a couple. That's either Loud Typer or Coffee McCann.
Coffee McCofferson.
Coffee McCofferson. But,
Esquire.
Yeah.
All right, guys. So we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks a bunch for listening. Have a good night.
See you guys.
Bye, guys.